Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The goat's horns were curved and sharp at the ends. His eyes were suspicious and baleful as he stared down the aging man stepping gingerly over the woven fence that surrounded the corral. The other few male goats kept well clear of the ornery patriarch of the herd, and so did most of the herders in the village. Carefully, without getting too close, the man used his long stick and a few exaggerated gestures to get the old goat moving, driving him out of the enclosure toward the low, mud brick walls of the houses beyond. The other goats in the flock followed him, driven onward by a few more herders. They needed less encouragement. Deep bellowing and thumping hooves soon drowned out the goat's bleating. The elderly man in the enclosure felt his heart leap when he saw the long horns of the zebu projecting upwards and the hump behind it. One wrong move and the bull would drive that horn right into his gut. He had caught the zebu as a calf down at the nearby stream and raised it for the past decade, but it wasn't tame. The man had no illusions about that. Carefully, he thought, carefully. Opening the gate and keeping his eyes locked onto the bull as one of his sons drove the big, angry creature into the enclosure with a few flicks of a flexible branch. The zebu glared at the older man but complied, heading for the basket full of fresh-cut grass that had been left for him to eat. The herder breathed a sigh of relief as he stepped out of the corral and closed the gate behind it. He dropped his long stick and walked toward the mud brick walls, the exteriors plastered with mud and painted with red ochre. He waved a welcoming hand to the group of hunters making their way into sight, carrying bloody hunks of meat carved from a water buffalo and the whole corpse of a jackal. Pausing for a moment near his home, he inspected the flint work one of his sons was doing, chipping off small pieces of razor-sharp stone, microliths, which could be used as spearheads, the saw-like blades of a sickle, or for a dozen other purposes. He offered a correction, hold the flint core at more of an angle to get a slightly larger flake, and moved on into the village. He eyed the ladder leading up onto the roof of his home with the same suspicion as the goat had looked at him. His hips and knees ached. He had no desire to climb up, only to climb down again, up and down, his joints hurting all the time. That was the price of experience, he thought, looking back toward the zebu bull in the corral and his son's improving flakes. This community, which researchers know today as Mehrgar, was alive with the sounds of farming, herding, hunting, and work more than 8,000 years ago. Located in the hills of Balochistan in present-day Pakistan, exactly 100 miles from the slow, winding waters of the Indus River, Mehrgar was one of the earliest farming communities in South Asia. This village and its contemporaries were the beginning of a long and winding road that led all the way to the independent development of one of the world's first civilizations, the Indus Valley Civilization, which laid the groundwork for everything else that's followed in South Asia over the past 4,000 years. Also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our Seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy or ebook from your distributor of choice right now. I'm working on getting a pre-order page for the audiobook, which I'll be reading. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Enjoy. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The region between the Hindu Kush Mountains, the Himalayas, and the Bay of Bengal, what we can broadly call South Asia, is one of the cradles of human civilization. Today, South Asia is home to about one in every four people on the face of the planet, living in Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Nepal, and Sri Lanka. Cities like Delhi, Mumbai, Dhaka, Karachi, Kolkata, Lahore, Bangalore, and Chennai all have more than 10 million inhabitants, and they're among the fastest-growing urban areas in the world. This region has a long, complex, and multifaceted history. It stretches back thousands of years through colonial rule, a series of empires, cultural efflorescences, religious upheavals, invasions, and migrations. Even the written record in South Asia is ancient. It goes back more than 3,000 years to the religious texts of the Rig Veda, texts that are still in use today. Before that continuous written record came into being, one of the earliest urban civilizations in the world made the Indus Valley home to some of the world's first cities more than 4,000 years ago. The Indus Valley civilization, as this Bronze Age culture is usually known, is usually counted as one of the world's pristine inventions of civilization. The Indus Valley civilization formed one of the key foundations of everything else that followed over the coming millennia, from what's now the fringes of northern Pakistan all the way to the mouth of the Ganges. We'll spend all of next week's episode talking about the Indus Valley civilization, so what it was, how it grew and flourished, and of course, why it eventually disappeared. But everything has a beginning. Before the Indus Valley civilization came into being, the Indus Valley was home to small communities of farmers. Hunter-gatherers wandered the Deccan Plateau and made their homes along the banks of the Ganges River, where they fished and collected shellfish. Some of these groups were even experimenting with plant cultivation. Recent discoveries suggest that we should count South Asia as yet another independent center of plant domestication. Who were these early inhabitants of South Asia? Had their ancestors always lived there, or had they, like people all across the planet, arrived from elsewhere? What were their lives like, and what led them along the winding paths to becoming one of the centers of global civilization? Before we get to the Indus Valley, we need to head back to the west, over the Hindu Kush, through what's now Afghanistan, and across the Iranian plateau, until we reach the Zagros Mountains, overlooking the broad plains of Mesopotamia. This was the fringe of the Fertile Crescent, that curving area extending from Israel and Lebanon in the west through Syria and northern Iraq onto the edges of the Iranian plateau. The Fertile Crescent, if we remember back a ways, was where the Neolithic and farming was born. At least, the Fertile Crescent was one of the world's places where people invented agriculture. We now know that there were many, many more, including a couple of spots in East Asia, New Guinea, and several in the Americas. The version of the human past where all the good stuff started in the Fertile Crescent 10,000 or 12,000 years ago is flatly wrong. But the Fertile Crescent did matter a great deal. That's where wheat, barley, peas, lentils, sheep, goats, and cattle were all domesticated, and it's from where they spread all across the planet. Those domesticates formed the subsistence basis for thousands and thousands of years of agricultural societies. They continue to feed billions of people today, so it's safe to say they're pretty important. Now, we still have a lot of questions about the emergence of farming in the Fertile Crescent, but compared to the invention of agriculture elsewhere in the world, we have a lot more information. We can tell a pretty detailed story about it and about how that farming package expanded outward. In its basic form, the story goes like this. Over the course of a couple of thousand years of experimentation, people in the Fertile Crescent figured out how to cultivate wild wheat, barley, and whatnot, and they began to control the ancestors of domesticated animals. After a couple of thousand more years of this, those crops and animals took on the visible characteristics we associate with their domesticated forms. The plant seeds got bigger, for example. The goat's horns got smaller. Thanks to these innovations, the groups of people who made these discoveries saw a rise in their numbers. They founded new communities and expanded outward, taking their farming way of life with them. That's the basic story, anyway. As we dig deeper into the details, it gets more complicated and, frankly, more interesting. As it turns out, the Fertile Crescent was home to a bunch of different groups of people. On a genetic level, and presumably a linguistic and cultural one, there were at least three different populations in the region. The Natufians and their descendants in the Levant, a group in southern Turkey and northern Syria, and then a third group in the east that lived in the foothills of the Zagros Mountains. If we think about this in terms of hunter-gatherer group dynamics, it makes a lot of sense. We have relatively small populations, they're highly fragmented, and they're deeply diverged from one another. But one of the fascinating things about early farming is that the basic pieces of the farming package originated in different places within the Fertile Crescent, presumably among different groups, and then diffused outward to the other groups living in the region without the populations really coming together. There was no single group of early farmers, even within this region. There were several, and they went their own separate ways. The group in southern Turkey and northern Syria, for example, expanded into Anatolia and then Europe. Their direct descendants survive today, everywhere from Turkey and Greece to Ireland. We haven't talked much about that eastern group, though, the one that lived in the foothills of the Zagros. They're really important, too. Back in 2016, geneticists succeeded in sequencing the genome of a middle-aged woman who lived in the village of Ganj Dare in the middle Zagros almost 10,000 years ago. It's a really cool site because it's where the oldest evidence of the management of goat herds has ever been found. Getting the ancient DNA of a person who lived there at exactly that time tells you a ton about the past and future of the people who figured out these really fundamental innovations. When this woman's DNA was analyzed, they suggested that she was a member of an ancient group whose descendants now live all over Central and South Asia. In other words, these early farmers and herders living in the foothills of the Zagros Mountains grew in numbers, they expanded over the Iranian plateau and into Central Asia, and traveled south across the Hindu Kush into what would later become Pakistan and India. That story, with multiple groups of early farmers, is the more complicated twist on the basic version, what we call the demic diffusion model of farming. Farming leads to population growth, which leads to migration and the diffusion of the farming lifestyle. But, as it turns out, even this more complicated version of the story isn't quite right either. When we look at the genes of later people living in the Indus Valley civilization and present-day people living in Pakistan and India, they're not directly related to that herding woman from the Zagros. Instead, they're descendants of a population that was closely related to her and her people, but not that group, not exactly. The ancestors of the folks who brought farming to the Indus Valley had actually diverged from those Zagros goat herders a few thousand years prior to the development of the farming package, and they hadn't mixed with them since. I know this is a bit complicated. The genetic stuff can make your head spin, but bear with me for just a moment. This is especially complicated because the descendants of that Zagros woman's population did, in fact, expand into Central Asia. They introduced farming there, and they lived there well into the Bronze Age. It was natural to assume that this same group had also gone further south, to the Indus, but we now know that's not the case. It's a puzzle. There are two ways of interpreting this, both of which have pretty significant implications for how we understand the origins of farming in the Fertile Crescent. First, there was another distinct population, that would make at least four in total, living in the region at the time farming was invented. Then their population expanded, they moved outward, and eventually they ended up in the Indus Valley. It would just be that we haven't sampled ancient DNA from this specific group yet. The other possibility is that this group was living somewhere other than the Fertile Crescent, maybe the Iranian Plateau, and wasn't involved in the initial domestication of crops and animals at all. They just adopted them from those groups further to the west in the Fertile Crescent. It's even possible that they had already been living in the Indus Valley, or at least nearby, and didn't actually move much at all. Instead, they would have been a hunter-gatherer population related to those Zagros farmers that had already come east sometime before. Again, since we don't have samples directly from this group at this time, we can't identify exactly where they came from. Both of those things I mentioned are possibilities. They're both intriguing. On the one hand, it would tell us either that the Fertile Crescent was a much more crowded and interesting place 10,000 years ago than we thought, or that our demic diffusion model isn't quite right, that it's too simple, and that acculturation and adoption of the farming package really did happen. In this second case, it wouldn't just have been expansion and migration. There would have been contacts, the adoption of ideas and crops, and changing lifestyles too. My guess, if you were asking me, is that the ancestors of these future Indus Valley people and billions of people living in South Asia today were living somewhere to the east of the Fertile Crescent, probably on the huge expanses of the Iranian Plateau. They slowly adopted domesticated crops and animals before moving east toward the Indus Valley. Either way, it's a long, long way from the edge of the Fertile Crescent to the Indus Valley. It's about 1,400 miles or 2,200 kilometers. The terrain in between isn't easy. The Iranian Plateau is cut through by jagged ridges of hills and deep valleys. Much of it's extremely arid. It wouldn't have been welcoming for these early farmers. Eventually, however, some of them probably did come through Afghanistan, across the mountains, and into the Indus Valley. Maybe they came down through the famous Khyber Pass, famous in the millennia to come as the gateway for invasions and devastating raids into South Asia. Once these folks arrived in the Indus Valley, they found a gloriously fertile plain, some 800 miles long, over 1,200 kilometers, from the foothills of the Himalayas and Kashmir down to the Arabian Sea. The Indus Valley snakes its way southward, makes this dry landscape bloom, It occasionally overspills its banks and deposits fertile silt that's wonderful for farming. So for these early farmers setting up shop with their wheat and barley, lentils, legumes, sheep and goats, this would have been about as good a place as any in the world to live. The Indus Plain isn't nearly as broad as it is long. It's just a couple of hundred miles across, sandwiched between the hills and mountains that run along today's border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the arid expanses of the Thar Desert. In the north, though, the plain keeps going and going and going. It's framed on the south by the Deccan Plateau and on the north by the Himalayas, all the way to the Bay of Bengal. This eastern extension of the plain revolves around the Ganges, the other great river of South Asia. Only the Delhi Ridge, which isn't much of a barrier, divides the two enormous drainage basins from one another. Put together, this region is known as the Indo-Gangetic Plain. It's been the urban core of South Asia for as long as there have been cities there, because that's where the food could be grown to feed the largest numbers of people. That agricultural history goes all the way back to that arrival of those early farmers from further to the west. Their early villages formed the basis for the complex societies, urban civilizations, and empires that followed.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Before we go any further, let's take a couple of steps back. Aside from the genetic evidence, how can we be sure that agriculture actually did arrive in the Indus Valley from further west? Couldn't they simply have figured things out for themselves? This one's pretty straightforward to answer. It's because the suite of domesticated crops and animals that we see in the Neolithic settlements of the Indus Valley is the classic Fertile Crescent package. We see wheat, barley, legumes, lentils, sheep, and goats. They're morphologically identical to what people were doing further west. The chances of a group domesticating precisely that same package of crops and animals independently a couple of thousand miles to the east of a place that had already done it seems pretty small. So at least one part of the agricultural package that took root in the Indus Valley came from the Fertile Crescent. As I mentioned, the people who implemented it probably came from further west too, if not all the way from the Zagros themselves. But South Asia was far from uninhabited when they arrived. It wasn't an empty wasteland, it wasn't a pristine wilderness ready to be settled by intrepid pioneers. There were already a whole bunch of people living all over South Asia with a variety of lifestyles. Some of those groups were even experimenting with agriculture themselves, with a totally different series of packages of domesticated crops. This gives us yet another place in the world where plant cultivation was tried and succeeded. It's also yet another place where we see multiple groups of people of extremely different backgrounds, language families, and ways of life interacting. So who were the people who were living in South Asia, and what can we know about them? We have to start by understanding that there are very, very few sites in the region dated to the late Paleolithic, to the period immediately before the end of the Younger Dryas, around 12,000 years ago. We're not sure exactly why this was the case. There hasn't been much archaeological work done in a lot of places, but it probably had something to do with the prevailing environmental conditions. They were drier and cooler than they became in the early Holocene after about 12,000 years ago. There simply may not have been that many people across large stretches of South Asia.
The upshot of all this is that much of South Asia, especially the Deccan Plateau, would have been really arid and not especially welcoming for a foraging lifestyle. But after the end of the Younger Dryas, things got much better. Conditions got warmer and wetter and generally more hospitable to people. We see a lot more archaeological sites throughout South Asia, and people were probably getting thicker on the ground. When I say things got warmer and wetter, what this means is that we can see the beginnings of the classic South Asian monsoon. Monsoon is really complicated, but basically it refers to the annual reversal of prevailing winds over South Asia that brings heavy rainfall and moisture through part of the year. It is the defining climatic feature of the region. It's the thing that dictates environmental conditions throughout India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Now, even today, the monsoon varies in strength and its details from one year to the next. This has huge effects on life and the economy in the region. That was the case in the past as well, and in fact, its path and effects were even more variable. So the Indus and the Ganges, the two biggest rivers of South Asia, are fed by sources high up in the Himalayas. They're going to run regardless, though maybe not with as much water volume at times when the monsoon either isn't as strong or is altogether absent. But that's not the case in the Deccan Plateau, where most of the rivers are fed by monsoon rainfall. In the late Paleolithic, the monsoon systems seem to have been either exceptionally weak or just not there at all. That meant that the Deccan Plateau would have been incredibly dry, way too dry for many people at all to live there. Even the Indo-Gangetic Plain would not have been as welcoming without regular rainfall and floods to replenish the soil with river silt. This probably explains why we start to see way more archaeological sites in South Asia after the beginning of the Holocene around 12,000 years ago. It was just a lot easier to live there. The site of Damdama on the Ganges Plain about halfway through Lucknow and Patna would have been a pretty great place to live around 8,000 or 9,000 years ago. It sits on a raised patch around the confluence of two rivers, tributaries that flow into a larger river, and it's one of a bunch of sites on the Ganges Plain dating to roughly this period of time. The other well-known sites tend to be at the edges of oxbow lakes. They're similarly rich spots from which to hunt, fish, and gather a bunch of plant foods. At Damdama, there were tons of microlithic artifacts, these small, razor-sharp, multi-purpose stone tools that we see a lot of during this Mesolithic period globally. There were also post holes, probably the frameworks for thatched or tent-like dwellings, fireplaces, and storage pits. So there are a couple of really fascinating things about these kinds of Mesolithic sites on the Ganges Plain. First, they show repeated occupations, with people living there for pretty extensive periods of time. Damdama has especially thick deposits, at least 10 separate layers of occupation over a pretty long time. People came there, they stayed for quite a while, and they kept coming back. Now, second, these sites all have cemeteries. They have big gatherings of the dead. There are 47 adult burials at Damdama, which is a ton of people for a cemetery in this period anywhere in the world. Why do cemeteries matter? Well, because cemeteries usually represent permanence in the landscape. It's the kind of place that matters to you and your group. You bury your dead there to show that the land is yours, that it belonged to your ancestors, and it'll belong to your descendants too. We talked about this in the context of the Nile Valley a few episodes back. People might wander, but the dead stay in place. Maybe there was something similar happening at Damdama and places like it in the Indian Mesolithic. Thanks to the skeletal remains found in these cemeteries, we can know quite a bit about the lives and lifestyles of these folks. At Damdama, the people were tall and healthy. Men averaged around 180 centimeters tall, around 5'10", while the women were around 174 centimeters tall, or 5'8". They tend to have strong muscle attachments, particularly in their calves, which suggests a lifestyle that involved a lot of walking up and down hills over long distances and or lots of carrying heavy loads. They also have really well-developed musculature in their forearms and shoulders, which researchers think came from a lot of forceful overhand throwing with the dominant hand. Basically, they spent a lot of time and energy throwing spears or bolas, maybe, with their right hands. They may have been on the receiving end of thrown spears, too. A few of the skeletons have projectile points either embedded in the bone or in a position that makes us think they were buried in the soft tissue at the time the body went into the ground. But there's little evidence for osteoarthritis or damage from repetitive movement patterns, the kind of stuff you see a lot of among farming populations that spent a lot of time stooped over grinding grain or pulling weeds, things like that. Now, their teeth were quite heavily worn, which suggests that they ate a lot of coarse plant foods that required serious chewing. But from their overall health, the food was varied, nutritious, and good for the people who ate it. The people who lived at Dom Dama haven't been genetically analyzed, as far as I know, so we can't be exactly sure about their population affinities, but we have some ideas about who they were related to and whether they left descendants. When we look at present-day people living in South Asia and samples from the time of the Indus Valley Civilization, we see a few major ancestral components, two of which are relevant to today's episode. One of them is those farmers, related to but not identical with the goat herders from the Zagros Mountains that I talked about earlier. But the other is a little harder to pin down. It's related to but not identical with people currently living in the remote Andaman Islands of the Bay of Bengal, between the Malay Peninsula and the southeastern coast of India. That specific type of ancestry, which researchers call ancient ancestral South Indian, reaches its highest proportions in the tribal groups of India. Now, this doesn't mean that ancient ancestral South Indians, whoever they were, was a homogenous population, or that they were the only one living in South Asia prior to the arrival of the farmers from further west. But we can say for sure that they were in South Asia, their roots were extremely deep, and that they soon mixed with the newly arriving farmers. All the later people living in South Asia have large proportions of ancestry from both of these really ancient groups. It's a fairly safe bet that the people who were buried at Dom Dama all of those thousands of years ago were representatives of this ancient ancestral South Indian group. It's possible, though impossible to prove at this point in time, that the Dravidian languages of South Asia go all the way back to this population. These aren't the only components of ancestry in South Asia, either. There are later arrivals after this period, including ancestry going back to people who originally came from the Eurasian steppe, and ancestry related to people living in East Asia. But the Zagros farmer-related ancestry and the ancient ancestral South Indian components are the two biggest ones. The vast majority of the ancestry of people living in South Asia today, in varying proportions depending on region, ethnic background, social group, and whatnot, goes back to these two distinct populations. Let's come back to our farming friends. Around the time the foragers were burying their dead at Dom Dama, permanent settlements were beginning to crop up in the Indus Valley and its environs, 1,000 miles to the northwest. The best known of these sites, the one that drives a great deal of our understanding of how farming took hold and spread in South Asia, is a place called Mehrgarh. Mehrgarh is an absolute treasure. In a really limited and pretty well excavated area, we can see the entire millennia-long sequence leading directly from the earliest farming communities near the Indus all the way to the emergence of cities and complex societies. There are very few sites more important in the entire world. Mehrgarh is actually located just to the west of the Indus Valley proper, in what's called Balochistan. In point of fact, it's basically where the Indus Valley and the Iranian plateau meet, a kind of a gateway between the two worlds. The part of Balochistan in which Mehrgarh is situated looks pretty forbidding today. It's really dry, it's flanked on three sides by sizable mountains. Around 7000 BC, though, it would have been quite a bit wetter and more appealing. That's when we see the earliest phases of permanent settlement at Mehrgarh, with people there living in small, unfired mud brick buildings. This is an incredibly early date. It's as early as the evidence for Neolithic settlements around the Aegean Sea, quite a bit further away and harder to get through from that Fertile Crescent homeland. These folks in what's called Period 1 at Mehrgarh were exploiting grain resources, namely barley and wheat. There's a bit of debate among scholars as to whether it was wild or domesticated, collected or cultivated, and if it was domesticated and cultivated, whether that was an independent development at Mehrgarh or introduced from further west. This brings us back to that really basic, fundamental question of who these early farmers were, whether they'd been in the area for a while already, or whether they themselves had migrated from further west along with their crop package. What's clear about Mehrgarh, and very few things are, is that in the earliest stages, the people who lived there were eating all sorts of things. Tons of grains and some domesticated goats, but also lots of wild game, including wild sheep and goat, wild cattle, water buffalo, even elephant. That's a broad-spectrum subsistence strategy. It's not one that relied entirely on introduced domesticated elements from further west. So, who were they?
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
It's not like we can look further to the west and track the movement of farming communities from the Zagros Mountains and the Fertile Crescent across the Iranian Plateau and then all the way to Mehrgarh. In fact, Mehrgarh predates the earliest farming communities that have been excavated on the Iranian Plateau. Now, some archaeologists look at that evidence and say it points in the direction of the independent rise of farming at Mehrgarh and in its region. That's what the archaeologist who excavated most extensively at Mehrgarh, Jean-François Yariguet, believed. Or at least that there was a combination of independent domestication along with some diffusion from the Fertile Crescent. That may be the case, but I'm not convinced. Mostly because today we have a much better idea of how migration operates. We don't have to find some slow, steady advance of farmers moving one valley at a time across the Iranian plateau toward Mehrgarh. That's not really how migrations work. Now, sometimes farmers do take short hops. The village gets too crowded, there's no more land available, a group will head out to the closest viable location and set up a new village. They maintain close connections to the place they left. If it's a group of young men moving, which it often is, they look back to their home communities for spouses, and you retain these connections over space and time. But these short jumps go hand in hand with much longer distance migrations that can cover hundreds or even thousands of miles. A great deal of the Iranian plateau is inhospitable to the kind of farming that worked well in the Fertile Crescent. There isn't enough rainfall, or the soil isn't right. You'd have to adapt specific pieces of the package and develop new techniques to get it to support viable farming communities. Under those circumstances, people might move exceptionally long distances in search of the right conditions to set up new communities. Now, if you were a group of new arrivals who was looking for a place to live, the area around Mehrgarh would have looked dang near perfect in comparison to the drier, less hospitable reaches of the Iranian plateau. It's worth moving to, in other words. Now, if this group was already living further east than the Fertile Crescent, as I think, they might already have had a sense for what they might find at the end of their migration. They might have had knowledge of it already, either through trade contacts or travel themselves. So if we stop looking for a continuous chain of farming migrations and instead think in terms of possible longer distance leaps, it's not nearly as hard to see Mehrgarh as at least partially the product of migrations from further west. They would have just skipped over the in-between parts they already knew wouldn't work for them. So as a working theory, I think that these folks moved across the Iranian plateau and eventually wound up around Mehrgarh. They may have been in contact with a group already living there. Maybe they shared some cultural facets in common with them. We don't know a ton about the preceding Mesolithic period in the region, but there isn't some huge dramatic shift. So let's say we're walking toward that first settlement, period one, at Mehrgarh. What would we have seen? Well, we would have walked through fields of wheat and barley, heading toward the low walls of the shelters in which people lived. The buildings were made of mud bricks. Bricks are uniformly shaped and sized, but they're unfired. They're covered with mud plaster, and they're often painted with red ochre. They look a bit strange at first glance, and we realize that's because they don't have any doors. Instead, people climb ladders and then come down into the dwellings from above. They're small rooms, but there are a lot of them, broken down into maybe 75 total structures on the site. At this point, practically all of the animals we see in their pens are goats rather than sheep or cattle. This makes sense because goats could have thrived on the Iranian plateau. Sheep and cattle would have been a lot harder. The goats may have had some cultural meaning beyond their subsistence use. As we're watching, we catch sight of the burial of a young woman. She's dug down into a pit and placed in between the mud brick houses. The remains of several young goats are placed in the pit with her, near her feet, and a sickle is carefully laid next to her head. As time went on, century after century, the people of Mehrgarh filled in the lower layers of their mud brick houses and built new structures on top. In some cases, they buried their dead inside these older layers. They cut down into the filled-in old rooms and placed the deceased inside. Later, they built whole cemeteries, and the site moved around in the vicinity of this first location. Mehrgarh was a sizable settlement from the very beginning, and later phases were even bigger. It had a sense of permanence, and it eventually developed a mound structure of the kind we see further to the west in the Fertile Crescent, Anatolia, and the Balkans. From Mehrgarh and the other settlements around it, populations rose, and people moved south and east into the Indus Valley itself. The later layers at Mehrgarh show the organic development of this specific farming tradition.
wherever it came from, whatever the ultimate origins of the farming package here, it eventually got in touch with what was happening further to the north and west. It maintained some contact with farming communities in Central Asia and the Fertile Crescent. But, and this is important, it also developed along its own lines in really interesting ways. At first, the people of Mehrgarh only hunted wild game and tended goats. The bones of sheep and cattle are almost absent from the remains. But there was a local wild cattle variety living in the vicinity of Mehrgarh. And these farmers domesticated that local wild cattle, the lineages ancestral to the modern Zebu, one of the two major lineages of cattle surviving today. In fact, Mehrgarh itself may have been the actual center of domestication for this lineage. It was the Zebu, rather than Fertile Crescent cattle, that eventually spread throughout South Asia and beyond. The domestication of the Zebu was just one component of this local South Asian Neolithic flowering. In fact, it was just one of the Neolithics, plural. Unlike in Europe, where we see the basically complete introduction of the Neolithic way of life and its spread throughout the continent, that's not really what happens in South Asia. Instead, we have this one ultimately introduced but also organically developing Neolithic tradition around Mehrgarh and spreads into the Indus Valley. There were other settlements that echoed what was happening at Mehrgarh that we found by the middle and late 4000s BC. But we also have other lines of development elsewhere in South Asia. Other ways of life, other groups, other crops, other technological and cultural complexes that moved in many different directions. So, multiple Neolithics in South Asia, not a single Neolithic. If we head north from the Punjab and the Indus Valley, we see another distinct Neolithic way of life emerging in the high valleys of Kashmir and Swat, extending west toward the Khyber Pass that separates Afghanistan from Pakistan today. The foothills of the Himalayas, Karakoram, Pamir, and Hindu Kush mountains, the highest on the planet, make a formidable barrier, but they also provide rich rivers that flow through fertile valleys, places that provide great pasturage for domesticated animals and some good farmland. The mountains are also studded with passes and pathways, and those routes tied this region to several different worlds. This Neolithic tradition began a fair bit later than it did at Mehrgarh, with the earliest dates coming from around 3300 BC rather than between 6000 and 4000 BC. They also seem to have adopted the crops of the Indus Valley and ultimately the Fertile Crescent tradition, especially barley and wheat. After around 2000 BC, this Kashmir/Swat tradition also had connections to Central Asia, what's now Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, even China further to the east. Jade beads and rectangular sickles that are similar to those of the Yangshao culture along the Yellow River, thousands of miles away, have been found in sites of this culture in northern Pakistan. Now, this extends a bit later in time, toward 2000 BC, even beyond, so we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here yet. Let's head southeast from there, out of the mountains, past the Indus Valley and along the Ganges. This plain, as we talked about a little earlier, was a pretty great place for the foragers of the Indian Mesolithic. These were the people who hunted, fished, and gathered plant foods at places like Damdama, as far back as the early Holocene. They, or groups like them, followed their own trajectory toward agriculture, their own Neolithic. The site of Lahura Dewa in Uttar Pradesh, along a former tributary of the Ganges, shows evidence of the heavy use of wild rice or even active cultivation of it as early as 7000 BC. The people of Lahura Dewa were living in a permanent settlement. They were gathering the native local rice and making the earliest pottery vessels found anywhere in South Asia. That's as early, maybe even earlier, than the first layer of settlement at Mehrgarh. Based on the stone tool technologies, this Neolithic tradition seems to have grown locally out of the preceding Mesolithic. Other sites seem to document a similarly evolving way of life based around wild rice exploitation and then later on, cultivation. Their handmade pottery vessels even used rice husk for the temper, which strongly suggests not just gathering wild rice, but planting it. They also hunted everything from rhinoceros and elephant to wild cattle as well. This is all far from settled, though. There are real problems with absolute dating in the sites along the Ganges. There just aren't many radiocarbon dates to work with compared to sites in Europe, East Asia, or the Near East. A bunch of these really important Neolithic sites have absolutely no radiocarbon dates at all. Now, whenever you're working with radiocarbon dates, you want more rather than fewer, for a couple of specific reasons. First, because there's always the chance that whatever you're sampling is contaminated or was somehow moved into the layer from which you excavated it, either from above or below.
And second, because radiocarbon dates are expressed as probabilities covering a range of years rather than a single absolute point in time. So the more of them you have, the more precise that range becomes. I want to stop and talk about rice for a moment. Now, we know that rice was domesticated along the Yangtze River in China and possibly a bit to the north of there as well, starting early in the Neolithic. The rice we're talking about around the Ganges belonged to a different subspecies, and it had its own complex history. It's complex not least because this East Asian domesticated rice was eventually introduced to the eastern parts of South Asia via Southeast Asia by migrants whose ancestors had ultimately come from what's now China. This introduced domesticated rice eventually hybridized with the native wild variety. This later hybrid was what took off as a cultivated crop in South Asia after about 2000 BC. All of this later stuff makes it really tough to nail down the early history of wild rice cultivation and domestication in South Asia. But what we can say for certain is that there were foragers exploiting wild rice, and then at some point they started to cultivate it. It's just that we can't tell whether the local variety of rice ever took on domesticated characteristics prior to the introduction of rice via Southeast Asia. So we know that there were some steps toward domestication of rice in South Asia. But it wasn't the only plant native to South Asia that foragers and later farmers adapted for their own uses. Mung bean, erd bean, and horse gram were the most important of these, along with a couple of varieties of millet that grew locally. These crops ended up being essential to the development of the Indus Valley Civilization and the later agricultural societies in South Asia for one simple reason. They could be grown in the summer during the monsoon season. Those West Asian crops that had been introduced from the Fertile Crescent, like wheat and barley and chickpeas, were winter crops. By combining these indigenous domesticated plants and rice with the Fertile Crescent crops, agricultural societies in South Asia ended up with a much broader and more versatile base for subsistence. There's still more to the story, though. So far, we've only really talked about the fringes of the Great Mountains and the Indo-Gangetic Plain in the north. That's only one part of South Asia. There's also Gujarat and the Deccan Plateau, which had their own Neolithic transitions. As with the Ganges Plain, this involved local domestications of indigenous plants. Things like mung beans may have been domesticated several times. But also the introduction of domesticated zebu cattle from the Indus Valley and Balochistan. Lifestyles in Gujarat and the Deccan, where it was drier, were better suited to mixed subsistence patterns and especially nomadic cattle pastoralism of the kind we talked about in the Nile Valley. In fact, in my interview with the archaeologist David Wengro, he talked about how the ash piles of the Deccan in this period directly paralleled the scatters of pastoralist remains in the pre-dynastic Nile Valley. So let's bring this all back together. One recent paper by Charlene Murphy and Dorian Fuller, two of the world's experts on early plant cultivation in South Asia, suggests that there were no fewer than five separate areas of indigenous plant cultivation in the region. That's pretty amazing, especially alongside the introduction from outside of the Fertile Crescent crops and later domesticated rice from East Asia. That's why we're talking about multiple Neolithics, not just one. All of this makes South Asia a unique mosaic of agricultural ways of life. There were enormous amounts of interplay between these various ways of cultivating and herding. The lifestyle packages that eventually emerged drew on all of them. In the Indus Valley, people came to cultivate both the winter and monsoon crops, they herded zebu cattle, and they grew rice as well. We're talking about tremendous diversity. We would expect that based on the geography and the ecology, with everything from tropical rainforest to floodplain to mountain to desert, but the human element makes it even more compelling. People moved around, they tried new things, they adopted new animals, plants, and ideas. They grew in numbers, they settled in villages and then cities, and before long they invented complex societies and what we think of as civilization. That's what we'll talk about next time on Tides of History. The Indus Valley Civilization, one of the foundational pieces of the history of South Asia. The IVC, as it's called, deserves to be held alongside Mesopotamia, Egypt, the Andes, Mesoamerica, and East Asia as a center of cultural development and future inspiration. But it's not nearly as well known. Let's see if we can fix that. Until then, thanks for joining me. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and videos in a post to go along with each episode. I also write the occasional essay on current events in a historical perspective, but feel free to skip those if you just want the prehistory. Again, that's patrickwyman.substack.com. I've written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I'll be reading from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that'll take you there. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA, or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. As I mentioned, I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Lewin. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.